Well, good afternoon. This is the House Energy Committee. I'm calling to order today. It's Thursday, March 26th, and the time is 1:09 p.m. Members present are Representative Costello, Co-Chair Mears, and myself, Co-Chair Holland. I'd like to remind members and staff that we're allowing members to use electronic devices during the committee meetings, but please silence your cell phones. As a reminder, staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Tim Truer, up here in the corner, or you might put into service our past Energy Committee aide, Shana Kilcoyne, who's joined us today. I think she probably remembers how this works. It's so good to see you here today. Thank you. Before we get started, I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Cheryl Cole, who's up here in the other corner, and Renzo Moises in the back from the Juno LIO for technical support. Today, we'll be hearing a presentation from representatives of the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the University of Alaska Anchorage on the Alaska Energy Data Gateway Initiative, which is led by the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, or ACEP. With us today, we have Ms. Vanessa Raymond, Deputy Director of Strategic Initiatives with ACEP, and Jeremy Casper, Director of ACEP, and Dr. Diane Hirschberg, Director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research. Director Hirschberg, Director Casper, and Deputy Director Raymond, please come up to the table, put yourself on the records, and we can begin your presentation. Thank you for being here today. And just to let folks know that Representative Johnson has joined us at 1:11. Thank you for joining us. And who's kicking it off here today?
Hi, I'm Diane Hirschberg. I am the director of the UAA Institute of Social and Economic Research.
Hi, everyone. I'm Leasi Vanessa Lee Raymond, the Deputy Director for Strategic Initiatives at Alaska Center for Energy and Power at University of Alaska Fairbanks.
And I'm Jeremy Casper. I'm the Director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Super. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead and begin.
So today we wanted to talk about energy data in the state. And to do that, we'll talk about the Alaska Energy Data Gateway. You've heard short bios, so we'll skip over those unless you have more questions about people's backgrounds. Very honored to be here with Dr. Diane Hirschberg and Dr. Jeremy Casper. And so we'll start with an overview of the two research institutions that are creating this revitalized energy data product for the state. We'll start with Alaska Center for Energy and Power and then move to Institute of Social and Economic Research.
So thank you, Vanessa. Many of you are familiar with ACEP, or the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, but we are an applied research institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We work on economic, social, and policy aspects of energy systems. We also do some in-depth technical work on energy systems modeling, technology testing, and then we also spend a considerable amount of time doing education, workforce development, storytelling, and knowledge network creation on these topics as well. We have a presence in Fairbanks. We have our lab presence there as well, but we also have sites throughout the state, including in Nenana, where we have our river energy test site. We have folks here in Juneau as well, and then we also have folks in Iceland as well, so some pretty broad coverage. Next slide, please. And we are on slide 6. So again, we are very much focused on developing practical solutions for Alaska that work here. And we also want to see more broadly Alaska leading nationally and internationally on how to do these things well and how to make them work, in particular for rural areas around the world that have similar challenges to Alaska. So next slide, please. Slide 7, our core research programs and education and storytelling programs are focused on marine energy. So this is river, tidal, and wave energy. PMEC is one of our core programs. We also have the Power Systems Integration Program. EPIC is under the lead of Dr. Gwen Holdman. Many of you know Gwen. That's Energy Policy and Innovation Center. And then education and workforce development. So some of our key programs there are the Energy Leadership Accelerator and the ARENA program, the Arctic Remote Energy Network Academy. We have Grid Edge team, which works on the technologies that you find at the edge of the grid. So basically, you're getting into the home or building level systems here. So heat pumps, electric vehicles, things that people can implement at their homes or businesses. And then storytelling team, some of our key programs there, the Closing the Gap podcast by Dr. Holdman. And then we also run the Energy in the North series, which is on the local KUAC station. And then, but we are here today to talk mostly about the work of the Research, Technology, and Infrastructure team, RTI. Some of the products they've worked on in the past may be familiar to the legislature, in particular, the Alaska Energy Trends Report, which was published in 2024. And it was an update of a report going back about 10 years prior to that. We put a substantial investment into the RTI team about 3 years ago now, and we're really bearing the fruits of that investment. And so with that, I think I'm handing it off to Diane yet. But quick facts and figures about ASEP. There's about 80 to 100 folks there, and we've got about total of $14 million in total expenditures. The majority of that is through federal grants. We have some core state funding. That's our unrestricted funding that basically lays the groundwork for all the other work we do. And then what I really want to talk about on this slide is the partnerships that we have. We recognize that a lot of the expertise in energy systems does not lie within the university, and it's within our partners throughout the state and then internationally and nationally as well. ICER, of course, is one of those close partnerships, but we partner with utilities, we partner with private sector organizations, we partner with other universities, national labs, and that's really a key of how we are successful. We also, a part of that is trying not to duplicate the work of others. So if there's expertise already existence elsewhere, we really partner up with those folks. And with that, I think I'm handing it off to my key partner at ICER, and we're on slide 9.
Yes. So hi, this is Diane Hirschberg, director of ICER. And those of you who were at our Lunch and Learn earlier this week, I apologize if some of this is redundant, but one of our most robust partnerships within the University of Alaska system is with ASEP. And so I'm very excited to be here today sharing what I think is also one of the more important products that the university produces, not just across our shared institutes. And so, as many of you know, ICER was founded by the legislature in 1961. We were tasked with developing and publishing statistics and other information regarding the economy, government, and resources of the state. And of course, on this photo, many of you would recognize in the center, Vic Fisher, who was the first director of ICER. And then to Vic's right is Lee Gorsuch, who he recruited to be director of ICER and became the longest serving chancellor for the university. And on his left is Jack Cruz, who followed Lee as director. Slide 10, please.
And if I could just acknowledge that Representative Edgman has joined us at 118. Thank you.
Thank you. And so ICER at the University of Alaska Anchorage has been at the forefront of public policy research in the state since 1961. And we have a multidisciplinary staff that studies many of the public policy issues facing the state, along with issues important across the Arctic. And so this work is intended to help Alaskans and residents across the North better understand the state and region's changing economy, population, and infrastructure, and the challenges and opportunities that come from change. And so again, we collaborate with these projects across the university system and with institutions across Alaska, as well as elsewhere in the U.S. and Arctic. ICER's faculty and research professionals teach, we mentor, we do public service, and we have a large team. We have about 11 faculty, 14 research professionals, we've got graduate students, and then affiliates and collaborators, again, across the University of Alaska system. Most of our funding comes from grants and contracts. The state does fund part of our administrative costs. That's passed through money to the University of Alaska and our teaching and some of our service. But otherwise, we bring in our own support. And our funding agencies range from contracts and grants with the state of Alaska and state legislature to the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, CDC, and again, in collaboration with ASEP, Office of Naval Research, U.S. Department of Energy, and many others. And then we have some very generous donors, such as Northrum Bank, who enable us to do work without it being tied to a specific contract. Slide 11, please. And of course, we have two centers within ICER, the Center for Alaska Education Policy Research, focusing again on education policy issues and really serving as a clearinghouse for education-related research across ICER and working very closely with state agencies. And then the Center for Behavioral Health Research and Services, which has a multidisciplinary team looking at collaborative research and evaluation on applied and behavioral health issues both within and outside of Alaska. Next slide, please. On slide 12. And again, we do teaching in a number of areas. Plus, we tend to work with graduate students a lot at UAF and then in other states and other countries. We love to come down and speak with our policymakers and answer queries from local and national policymakers as well. Public lectures and talks across Alaska, and of course, with the media. Slide 13. And so this is just that quick overview that our goal is enhancing the well-being of Alaskans through providing the information to help us make the best possible decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hirschberg. Just to reintroduce myself, Leasi Vanessa Lee Raymond, Deputy Director for Strategic Initiatives at Alaska Center for Energy and Power. You've heard a little bit about ASEP and ICER, and now we wanted to dive into the Alaska Energy Data Gateway. So this is a public resource. It's funded by the state, and the goal is to ensure energy and socioeconomic data is easily accessible. So really contextualizing energy data within the uses of energy data.
So just a brief pause here. As we start getting into the meat of this data gateway, do you have a preference in terms of questions as we go, or do you feel like this is going to build up that we ought to kind of wait till you get a little further along before we take you off onto bunny trails with information that maybe is coming up already?
I think we're fine with bunny trails. Yeah. However,
fair enough. Thank you. So as we go through each of the slides, as we start getting into the meat of this stuff, you might pause a second after each slide to see if there's any questions, and we'll proceed that way. And just so I can watch the pace, how many slides are there just so I kind of know where we're at roughly?
I think there's about 35 slides.
Okay. That'll help me just kind of watch the pace and the timing of the questions.
Slides.
So if we go off too far afield, know when we need to bring it back on there. Thank you for the pause.
Of course. So we're on slide 15. The AEDG, if you guys are okay with that acronym, is a public resource, and it continues to evolve. It was originally conceived in 2010 and has been revitalized three times now. So it's a highly valuable source of energy information that needs, as we're seeing, continued evolution. So ASEP and ICER have been working on this at every iteration. Version 1 in 2010 was funded by DOE EPSCoR and was a partner of ICER and ASEP. Version 2 really sustained and held through to up 2024 and was heavily used and referenced by people making policy, making energy decisions in the state. Again, that was ASEP, ICER, and Lawrence Berkeley National Labs who created the second version. And then in 2024, the legislature allocated funding for a third revitalization of the AEDG. And so ASEP and ICER came together again and really redesigned and reconceived the gateway. Slide 17, this is version 1 of the Alaska Energy Data Gateway. And slide 18, this is an animation using the Internet Archive of version 2. It's now only accessible there, but it was a list of key data sets that are relevant for energy in the state, and users could click through. They could find a data set they were interested in. They could select certain variables or attributes of the data they wanted to explore further, and they could download that data. This was used up until we revitalized it in 2025.
If you could, I'm just curious if you just summarize, how was that being used at the time, and were there any particular successes or examples where this data gateway was being used in some way that we can say we did this and we got this out of it or made this kind of use out of it? Any history, and that may be before your times, but I'm just curious.
So it was the definitive source for energy data in the state. And so researchers, policymakers were using it to understand really any of the questions about regional planning, specific remote community planning, and broader.
Hi, this is Diane Hirschberg. I think the other, while we were able to keep the data updated, and this is an important point I think to make, is that in 2024, the data was several years old because we did not have continuous funding to keep updating the databases. And there's nothing automated at that point for bringing in new data. But a lot of communities, tribal administrators, and so forth, also relied on this to be able to grab data that they could use for funding applications. And one of, I think, the concerns we had that really helped us advocate strongly for the third version is when that infrastructure funding was available and communities, you know, when Nils Andreessen was going and finding updated data almost manually because this was not something we were able to provide them. It was really an important call that we needed to have this available so that Galena is not having to try to bring this data together when they are applying for tribal or federal funding for building new energy infrastructure.
This is Jeremy Casper. And just anecdotally, we heard from a number of utility partners in particular who were actually taking data from the AEDG that they had provided, because this data is ultimately derived from the PCE data, reusing it for grant applications because it was in a much easier format for them to just grab and use.
And just to follow up on that, does this data and how it's used directly connect up with REF, Rural Energy Fund related applications and work? And it have the projects that have been funded ended up adding new data in here in any way that there's a feedback or support for that REF program?
Absolutely. So I don't have any specific examples, but again, my understanding from talking with folks is that they're able to use this data for applications, say, for the REF. Okay. But yes, the data does eventually feed back into the database as well because it's being reflected in the PCE filings.
Right. Thank you. Okay. Let's continue then. Thank you.
And this is Vanessa Raymond. Just to add, we also have been in talks with AEA about the Renewable Energy Atlas coming into the revitalized product. So moving to slide 19, if anybody would like to navigate to the site themselves, you can using the QR code and the URL. So we wanted to start with an example of a community. How might you use the AEDG? We selected ATCA. We're on slide 21. And the scenario is energy planning. ATCA is looking at lots of diversification of their energy generation, and you are interested in understanding, well, what does their system look like today? What are your options? You could call a friend. You could start Googling. You could call the city or tribe of ATCA. You could, if you know the energy resources out there, go to the AGC data portal, look up at the PCE filings. You could go back to 2016. There was a beautiful product in Tableau called RACI that people still use today. If you were to go to the revitalized AEDG, you would type in the name ATCA, and you would immediately be given a community dashboard of ATCA's broad socioeconomic and energy information. You have a map that you can immediately customize and add bulk fuel and power plants and utility service areas. Okay. And then you can find out more about the demographics, the power generation, the fuel and fuel delivery.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. So who created your dashboard for you? And is maintenance of it something that you contract out? And then do you have to have agreements with entities that whose data you're looking at or, you know, having to get access to their information before you bring it into yours?
So all of the data that we're using is publicly accessible data, Vanessa Raymond, from either the state entities or federal entities. We're just bringing it all together in one place. And then we have an in-house team at ASAP who are technical experts paired with energy subject matter experts who helped the two of our institutions build this. So this is university employees.
Thank you.
Did you need to finish up on something or?
Just clarifying that was through the chair.
Oh. Perfect. Yes, Dr. Go ahead.
So through the chair, I will say, I believe there was also a question about the sustainability of this work. And that is, has been continuously a challenge because there isn't an existing pot of money that continues, and there hasn't been in any of these iterations. So this is why you see sometimes these gaps in when version one, version two finished, that the data did not continue because, again, it's not automated in the way that maybe moving into the future we could get there. But the data sources vary in whether they are ready to go or whether they require more cleaning and reformatting in order to work in this kind of a format.
Great. And if I can follow up on that, this is the chair, co-chair. I was curious whether the data that you have here is in one direction or another connected with the community profile databases that I think CRA or through DCCED maintains on that, because I think that's been another challenge. Is a really valuable, I think they call them storybooks or something in their database, really valuable community profile information. It seems like this is an adjunct to that that might be interesting. I'm just wondering how those two things are hooked up and to the degree that it's a challenge maintaining the systems, if there's some way to think about how that's being managed, knowing that it's a challenge for everybody maintaining that. And I don't know if there's a cooperative relationship between the two.
The intent is to make it with as hands-off as possible. And so, yes, whenever we can, we rely on existing databases, such as the DCRA community profiles. Maybe Vanessa can speak to more how that's actually implemented on the more detailed answer there.
The short answer is yes, we definitely use their data. It's highly valuable data, mm-hmm. and we work with them and in close collaboration with DCRA.
And this is Diane Hirschberg. Back when we were working on iterations one and iterations two, we also actually, one of the people who was overseeing the DCCED data was married to one of ICER's faculty. So it made it, I mean, that relationship started strong and the support has been very strong all throughout. It continues even though neither of those individuals are in the state anymore.
Great. Thank you. Let's continue on. Yep.
So from the AEDG, it's easy to make briefings such as this example where you have insights into ATCA or any other community's energy system, and you're able to pull charts and graphs out of there that you've been able to customize through the platform. We're on slide 24. The goal of the revitalized AEDG is access, usability, and presentation of Alaska's energy data. We wanted to take the bones of the earlier product, the spirit of the earlier product, and bring it into the modern era. Slide 25. We've talked a lot about energy data, and you all may be very familiar with this definition, but we took to heart the definition from the Energy Data Subcommittee from 2023 that Energy data is information about electricity, heat, and transportation fuels, and it's about how it's sourced, generated, stored, distributed, used, and governed. That's a broad definition, and we try to bring that into everything that we build. Slide 26. Why do you need an energy data gateway in Alaska? Well, part of it is that Alaska's energy is quite complicated and quite diverse. With over 100 utilities, every utility has a different capacity, need, and interest in data collection. With over 180 grids, there's no single entity that's required to store or validate spatial data about these grids. And with both regulated and unregulated utilities, there's a huge variance in the type and the quality of data that's available, that's stored, and then made publicly accessible.
Great, thanks. I just want to acknowledge that Representative Ruffridge has joined us at 1:34. I wanted to also ask for clarification here. Maybe it'll surface again, but the focus on grids lends me to think that this is focused on electricity. And energy is obviously got a lot of different flavors. And I'm curious how the energy data you're collecting is looking at different forms of energy and some of the data that we might need down the road to be able to look at some of the trade-offs in different sources of energy and the transitions that are happening as we're perhaps bringing in new forms of energy to offset others. What's kind of the broader umbrella view of what energy is in this data set, and how does it connect up into the changes that are going on?
It's a great point. This is predominantly about electricity because there is little to no public data about heat.
Okay.
Yes. Yep.
This is Diane Hirschberg. There is a definition, and I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me, that was developed during the Energy Data Task Force meetings. Oh, there we have it. And I think you'll see here that we definitely ascribe to this definition of energy data, but again, it goes back to what is the availability, and we'll talk a little bit about that in toward the end of this presentation.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And Jeremy Casper here again. I would just add that dealing with the other forms of energy, and that's an ambition right now. Mm-hmm. For the most part, sales of fuel oil are unregulated, so tracking down individual usage is extremely time-consuming and often, in some cases, not even possible. So dealing with the heating side of things is very difficult, as is the transportation side of things. So definitely cognizant of those challenges and, thinking about how we might deal with those in the future.
Yeah, well, that'd be beneficial. You know, I'm just drawn to realizing some of the more interesting projects have been ones where there is an interplay between the electricity generation and some of the dispatchable load heating opportunities and seeing those benefits. And part of what I'm interested in is as we try to create more clarity on the value of the REF projects and the cost of energy in rural communities, how do we see those total costs so that we see more investable, more worthwhile, beneficial opportunities to put funding into those projects because we see a more complete picture of the total value being created in the community. And so this ability to, I think, have a greater understanding of beneficial electrification is probably going to get more visibility over time, and your data would be potentially a really valuable way to help us uncover some of the trends as well as the opportunities.
Absolutely. And there are you might be familiar with the energy cost burden analysis. So that's looking at a course level total cost of energy for a household throughout Alaska. So there are ways you can get a picture of the course view. It's getting down into the details where it gets quite a bit harder.
Yeah, great. And you're raising an important point that I know is getting a little bit more attention, which is what is the total cost of energy as opposed to the rate of energy. And in some cases, looking at the rate of energy being 50 cents or a dollar a kilowatt hour isn't the whole picture if we've found out new ways to actually lower the total cost of energy to a household. The rates may not tell us that we've made the same progress that we may be able to see if we saw the total cost of the household and ultimately the affordability of energy in rural and urban areas for that matter too.
Absolutely.
Right. Thank you. All right. Let's continue on, I think.
Moving to slide 27, in Alaska, energy data requires partnerships. So we've spoken a lot about the ASEP-ICER partnership. I won't go into more details there. It's just wonderful to bring the subject matter expertise of both units together in coordination. Moving to slide 28, the energy data that's used in the Gateway comes from many state sources, and no single agency's job is to bring all of this together, right? So we have Department of Labor, DOT, Revenue, Natural Resources, DCRA, which was already mentioned. Alaska Energy Authority is clearly a huge player here, Regulatory Commission of Alaska, but also Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Slide 29, there's also federal important data sets that we rely on to create a complete picture of energy data in Alaska. So the Energy Information Administration, clearly there's a lot of data there, but also the Census Bureau and the Geologic Survey. We also rely on another product called the Alaska Energy Statistics. It was then rebranded as the Trends Report. That, again, is no single entity's job to create that specific product.
Great, thanks. Representative Edgman.
Yeah, if we could go back to the previous slide, went through this fairly quickly. You know, data is only as good in some respects as the sources that, that it comes from. And it would be great to hear some of the limitations of data that's out there. I know in terms of Department of Labor, there's some really good sources of data, but there's also very limited analysis that comes forth, and so there must be some room to comment on what may be going right now in terms of data and what we could do to improve upon the data.
Through the chair, we are very grateful for public access to data, and we recognize that managing data and serving data is very difficult. As you pointed out, the data, you know, insights are only as good as what comes out. And so there's a reason why we have researchers and subject matter experts involved in this effort to ground truth the data that we receive, to cross-reference it with other sources, to collate and bring together very disparate and different data sets with lots of gaps. And so this holistic picture takes a huge amount of effort from people who know how to manage data and understand energy in Alaska. There are only so many teams in the state who can do that. And so I don't want to point fingers at any one agency because that is a huge effort in of itself. But yes, there are gaps and deficiencies for sure.
Yeah. Well, a follow-up with that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I only bring that up because not to pick any scabs off any post-office, so to speak. And maybe it's an offline conversation, but there's got to be some way we can be better partners through our state system.
Take a brief at ease. All right. We're back on the record in the House Energy Committee, and I believe we were in the middle of a follow-up from Representative Edgemon, but I apologize. I kind of lost track exactly where we were before the sky started falling.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we've covered the ground that I was seeking to cover, and that was just to get even just sort of a macro sense of some of the the strengths and certainly maybe some of the deficiencies, but I realize it's a much longer conversation because data is integral to everything we do, right? We're talking about the Renewable Energy Fund a moment ago and some other things. Mm-hmm. And, possibly a conversation for a standalone conversation for a meeting or something.
Okay, very good. Dr. Hirschberg?
Yes, through the chair, this is Diane Hirschberg. And we have a aligned project being done by one of our graduate students who is actually brought together a group of experts from many of these organizations to talk exactly about the challenges with data and what we'd like to see. Because in some cases, the data comes to us on, as we call them, dirty PDFs. So we're having to figure out how to scan or re-enter some of that data. And I will say that the Department of Education Early Development, that was a conversation we had with them a number of years ago, and they moved to providing much more data in downloadable Excel spreadsheets just because of that, which is great responsiveness. And the other piece is that I know you all will be hearing about SB 181, which has come over to the House, which is also from the Fisheries Task Force, because this question about data availability for the university affects numerous areas where we are collaborating actively with state agencies, but are not always able to act as a state agency in those collaborations. And so that is legislation that is trying to address that small piece of the pie.
Great. Thank you. Representative Costello.
Thank you. And that segues well into my question, which I had earlier. So you've mentioned that no one is really responsible for this, what you're doing. Are you asking that the legislature give you statutory backing or authority so that you could then have more ability to request the data in the formats that you want? That was one of my questions. And then I'm also interested in knowing, you had mentioned earlier you collaborate with Iceland and then also the national labs. And I was curious, in what capacity are you working with those, with the labs and also then with the country of Iceland?
Through the chair, I can respond to the question about collaborating with the national labs in particular. We work with them in a variety of different ways. Up until last year, I was actually a joint appointment with one of the labs, meaning I could be funded through them. We also have a number of memorandums of understanding with several different labs, which enables collaboration. We have several joint appointments within ACIP with national labs, but also more broadly within the university as well. And we're trying to increase that that overlap, especially with the National Lab of the Rockies, who has a presence in Alaska.
Through the chair, this is Diane Hirschberg. So we are not coming with a specific ask right now. I do think both in terms of the work that Ryan Witten is doing in our ongoing conversations, I do appreciate that. I think this is a further conversation about what does it look like for us to make this process more fluid and seamless. And I think we would want to have this conversation in partnership with these other entities because they also have faced constraints that we may not fully appreciate. And then in terms of the partnerships, ACIP has a staff person on the ground in Iceland who is also one of our doctoral students. So it's also in part through the ability of us to have graduate student researchers who are really scattered around the state and obviously the circumpolar north. And then Gwen Holden is not here, but there's an active partnership that has enabled ACIP to bring legislators from Alaska on tours in Iceland to see their approach to both infrastructure and financing of energy projects. And then we also have a very active partnership with University of Saskatchewan around understanding what are some of the mutual challenges and opportunities in our rural and remote micro-gridded communities. So there's a very robust set of international relationships that allow us to see perhaps different ways of approaching some of these challenges and for us to share some of the extraordinary innovations that Alaska offers to other northern communities.
Through the co-chair, how that works in practice is usually there's a agreement in place, such as an MOU. Actually, this image here on slide 28 is from a Arctic Energy Forum that we ran in Akureyri, Iceland, several years ago. And that was, that on paper, that was an organizational agreement with partners in Iceland. And that's how we operated that. And the intent is to run another one in Luleå, Sweden. Again, Iceland is a partner with that one as well, but also partners in Sweden. And again, there is an MOU that backs up that collaboration.
Right. Thanks. One more energy data question, I'm afraid. I was curious where the Alaska utilities fit into this data. I didn't see them in either one of the slides, and I assume that that partnership and the real world data that you're collecting from Alaska utilities is important. How does that fit into the energy data that's available through this gateway, but also perhaps it's feeding some of the work that you're doing?
Well, the utilities report to AEA, and so we get the data from AEA as well as EIA, the Energy Information Agency, a federal entity, and we receive that data there. We also ground truth and check the data that's in the gateway with the utilities because they understand their data in a way that, you know, they live and breathe that. Mm-hmm. And so they can very quickly look at a chart and say, that doesn't make any sense or that didn't happen in 2011. And so they're part of our user feedback group. But most of the data actually comes through the federal and state entities.
That's great clarification. Thanks. Anything else before we continue on? All right, let's continue on then.
Okay, we are on slide 30. This is Vanessa Raymond. So energy data requires these partnerships. It also requires people. So people like Clay Copeland, who is the from Cordova Electric Cooperative, he understands how the data at the moment it was created. Right. Then we have researchers like Michelle Wilbur and the tiny person in front of the wind turbine is Henry Toll, who collect data in the field and work with community members to understand the data in context. And then we have people like Alora Greer and Glenn Woodworth, who are in the photo with the pink glasses, where they are technical experts who can manage the data, wrangle the data, clean the data, and create these interactive charts and graphs that we can all use. Without all of these parts, we can't really get the insights that Alaska needs to move forward. So we're going to dive into the tool now, and I'll just say there's many GIFs and charts. So we're moving from slide 31 to 32. What's new? What did we build in the third version of the AEDG that wasn't in the former ones? Well, previously, the AEDG was about community summaries. And so you could find out information about one community. Well, if we think about context of energy in the state, regional grids are important. All of the communities in a house district are important. That level of kind of stepping up into the regional level helps everyone understand the context of data. So moving to slide 33 is an animation of looking at the grid for Bethel. So Bethel serving three communities through the Bethel grid, and we're able to visualize them, ask questions about them, understand the generation mix and the consumption for a regional grid. That means we can also look at the rail belt grid. With one click, type in rail belt, and you can see not only a map, but a list of all the power plants that are part of the grid. You can look at all the bulk fuel in the area. You can look at the capacity of the rail belt grid and all the generation sources. That type of product would take experts a while to make you one of those. Now you can do that with just a few clicks. Moving to slide 37, we can also put energy data in the context of different governance frameworks in Alaska. So if you are an Alaska Native corporation, you can see all of the communities relevant to your corporation in one view. Similarly, as a legislature, you can look at it by district. And moving to slide 38, we also increased the ability for people to customize what they see on the ADG. So you can click around and change a chart. You can sort data in your web browser. This is part of just how people use the modern internet, but it also allows us to serve more people. More people can say, I can get what I need from the AEDG. We also focused quite a bit on usability. The version 2 tool was getting a little long in the tooth. It would take a while for the page to load. You'd be confused, did I click that button or not? What's happening next? There was a lot of uncertainty. And so we tried to make something that was responsive, that was clear, that was understandable. That didn't happen overnight. We started system design in October of 2025. We did user research, which included sworn to secrecy interviews where people told us things about problems they had with data from specific agencies. And we allowed them to remain anonymous because we wanted people to speak freely. We spent and continue to spend a lot of time cleaning and validating data. And we also worked really hard on data visualization. How do people understand this data? What are they hoping to glean from it? How are they going to use it? That refinement happened through a lot of user feedback. And so we launched the 3.0 version in May of 2025. And we've spent, I think, every 2 to 3 weeks since then, we have pushed a new update because we have learned something new from the Clay Copelands of the world or the Diane Hirschbergs of the world who are saying, this doesn't make sense, or, oh, you forgot this. So we also have some future needs, and we'll get to those next.
Okay. And yes, go ahead, Dr.
This is Dr. Hirschberg. I just noticed, and I hadn't noticed this looking at this before, we are not time travelers. We actually began system design in October 2024.
Dang it. There you go. Thank you. Representative Hedgman.
Yeah, completely random, out of left field question. Is there any way to track how much the PFD is used on energy in Alaska?
Through the chair, this is a great question for me to take back to the ICER team, because I believe that some combination of Steve Colt and Matt Berman have asked this question at some time, but I would say, and it would be an interesting question even for a local utility, because as I can recall, when we had that big pulse in 2009, was it 2008? Governor Palin, that they did not see a huge number of people actually applying that energy rebate to the energy systems. I think that's a great question. I will take back to our team.
Follow up?
Yeah, I'd really appreciate that. The next big dividend was in 2022, 3,284, if I remember right. It would just be interesting to know if you know, speaking of data and impacts of, mm-hmm. You know, policies and stuff, it would be interesting to know what limitations you have in terms of tracking anything verifiable down.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Representative Mayers.
Thank you through the chair, Representative Edgman. Yeah, it'd be curious, like, what are the factors in there? Dr. Hirschberg and I had a conversation a couple of days ago about, like, being able to, like, prepay a bill and saying, I see this is coming. And, you know, so that's a data point, but also, like defaults or late payments or, like, because you can't track the actual dollars if there were some of those other things that happened around that. Right. Unfortunately, our economy is very complex and it's just one thing that gets tracked. So interesting question. I appreciate that.
I was curious on the revitalizing feedback improvement. How have some of the emerging energy players factored into this work? And I'm thinking of the IPPs that Census started are now a key new component and player that are kind of, you know, at arm's length to some of this. Some of the independent companies that are doing heat pumps and heat pump installation that are perhaps players in this. And I'm curious if their need for information in terms of helping them develop proposals and opportunities have played into this. Is this helping us identify maybe where there's some gaps in some of the infrastructure in our energy system for doing installations? I'm also thinking of the solar related players that are doing some solar projects. If they're either giving you feedback on how to use this to help them, or perhaps you're getting information from them, but what's happening with emerging electrification players that has maybe changed what is an AEDG or perhaps how it's being used that maybe has shown up in the feedback and improvements?
One of the most surprising pieces of feedback and uses was Trident is really interested in the tool and was looking at it quite heavily. So we didn't really consider industry interest in the tool. I mean, I'm embarrassed to admit we didn't, but trying to understand capacity and generation in communities where they might be interested in investing further or developing more arose as one of the early and most surprising use cases that we had. The IPP question, we'll talk a little bit more about IPPs later, but for planning purposes, we have seen people look at the ADG, and for grant applications, we have seen people look at it, trying to encapsulate an energy system in an application process.
Oh, if I can follow up on that then, and have you seen IPPs using this strategically to figure out where there's a business opportunity because of the data that says there's a really high cost of energy in an area that has good solar potential? And they're not necessarily using this for a grant, but they're saying, you know, this makes business sense to come in with a proposal, whether these are startups or emerging ventures. I'm wondering if you've seen that aspect of it that is helping.
I haven't directly seen that particular use case, but we have seen other questions from communities, tribes, and IPPs interested in energy projects in their area.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for that. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was just, first of all, I'd like to say thank you very much for, I kind of scanned through it, your app there. I used the QR code and I went and looked at it. So thank you. I appreciate it. My legislative district gave me some sense of being able to really look at my own district. So I think it was before the session, I know this, it may not be exactly, it should. I mean, you did some analysis of the gas line with the governor, ICER did. And I don't know if you talked about, if you were involved at all with the like local energy and how the gas line might interplay with particularly Cook Inlet. And if you did, I wasn't really sure. And then I'm certain that things have changed significantly in the world of energy since then. And I was wondering if any of that information had been updated or was maybe it's hard to update it, but boy, it's got to have changed a lot.
Hi, this is Diane Hirschberg through the chair. So that work was done by Brett Watson, Dr. Brett Watson. He is part of the AEDG team. I cannot say, I don't think that work has directly been involved with this, but we have his thinking on that. And I absolutely think, and we'll talk we're going to share something with you in a minute for a later conversation where we are very actively interested in these questions about the gas pipeline, the question of the economics, cost, and community interest in what opportunities it offers. We've got some, hot off the press data. But I think this is a good conversation to bring back. And I've got a note to take to Brett to see if there's a way for us to continue that discussion.
Okay, great. Thank you. Representative Rufford, did you have a question?
I did. Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Holland. And yeah, I'd like to
count myself in the thank you category for being here and for the data. I think it's really helpful to see. I was scrolling through in sort of preparation for this, and one of my questions was, how current is your data set, and how often is it updated? That seems like that would be a relatively difficult proposition.
So the current – oh, through the chair. The current data is from 2022. That is the most recent data that we have access to based on that Alaska Energy Statistics Workbook, which I mentioned is another key data set that is no one's job to update. And so it has been a sort of a labor of love for 40 years that somebody goes in and updates it. But yes, that is why we only have the data to 2022.
Thank you, Ms. Raymond. And when you jump on, it's helpful if you give us your name when you do that. It's a little tricks that I'm learning also along the way.
Yes. Dr. Hirschberg. So through the chair, this is Diane Hirschberg. That is for the energy data. There is more up-to-date, the demographic data, because of DCCED and Department of Labor. That demographic data, I believe, is 2024? I think it's 2024 data.
Okay. Just to follow up. Yep. I'm wondering, inside of the platform, and I wasn't in there super long, but it would be really helpful to have like a comparison feature in there. Is that something that I'm missing, or does that exist somewhere in that platform?
And I'm sorry, Representative Ruffridge, just could you clarify because I think it's an interesting question, but are you talking about comparing one community or one utility or one something to another? Is that where you're going with the question?
Yeah, all of those things.
Thank you for the clarification. Yes. Yeah, Ms. Raymond or someone wanted to take a shot at that?
Through the chair, this is Vanessa Raymond. Yes, that is on our roadmap for the next major feature we want to build. Creating the regional grids was our step to get towards comparing grids. Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thank you for that discussion. Let's continue on.
So we're on slide 40. This is Vanessa Raymond. Future needs for data are heat, natural gas, which we've touched on, independent power producer data, which was mentioned just briefly, and intertie data. So as discussed earlier, in the coldest state in the union, we do not have access to public heat and natural gas data, because those are private industries and they have no mandate and no requirement to share data in the way that a state agency does. So accessing that data is through relationships. It is through begging and pleading and crying. No, I'm just kidding. but regular, reliable, repeatable data processes don't exist. So if we are going to go back to the question about asks, this is a major ask. How do we get access to more data about heat and natural gas? This is slide 42. As we see more and more independent power producers who are interested in solar or wind, hydrogen, all sorts of things are cropping up. We see the independent power producers through the power purchase agreements. So in the data, we can see the sale. We don't actually see the full capacity of that power producer. And so if we wanted to have a holistic view of all of the capacity and generation sources in the state of Alaska, we wouldn't have that insight from the data that exists today. So getting more data and data sharing in the culture of these IPPs to the state would be helpful to really create a complete picture of energy in the state.
If I can follow up on that, is there a model in other states where IPP data is more transparent? Are we an outlier in terms of not being able to see this? Because I know in other states, IPPs are much more prevalent in terms of a model for power. And are we ahead, behind, or is this an easy to solve problem if we update?
This is Vanessa Raymond. I don't think we have an answer to you whether we're ahead or behind other states, but we can look into that. And that is a great question. I was wondering if it had anything to do with regulations in FERC, which Alaska doesn't have FERC regulations.
Yeah, that would be interesting to follow up, because I think we're going to continue to see the IPP model as more important. So making sure that we are helping them with information so that they can be more successful, but also on the flip side that we're receiving information so that we can see the impact. I think there's a two-way street here that everybody's a little bit better if we know a little bit more about the model. Okay, let's continue on then.
This is Vanessa Raymond. We're on slide 43. Another thing that we're seeing more and more is interties between communities from a cost perspective. We've had research from Dr. Holdman that this reduces costs for remote and rural utilities. From an energy security and resilience perspective, we're also seeing that that can create more redundancy and backup for communities. However, there's no current intertie data set. So we can try to make one, but it would be great if at the state level there was more of a standardized data set that was out there and vetted. And that's just to put in your mind as something that's a challenge we believe should be in the AADG, but we'd be limited in the data that's available right now. Slide 44, it sounds like some of you have already done this, but call you to go and visit the AADG. We would love feedback, and we do take it into account and solve problems that you identify, build new things that you're dreaming of. So do not be shy about any thoughts that you have there. And then last but not least, this is a big team effort. And so we're here speaking on behalf of many people who are very passionate about this. Their names and their faces are here, but thank you very much for supporting this project and also for listening to us today.
Great. Thanks for the presentation. I wanted to go back half a step, I think, and ask about two things. In the case, and this is largely, I realize, rail belt, but I'm wondering if it provides framing with the Rail Belt Reliability Council and the Integrated Resource Plan, is that work to develop standards and to develop plans impacting the data and what you're collecting and how it gets used? Or said the other way, will the standardization process and the integrated resource planning process, is that going to maybe drive what data you have and how it's presented for alignment between those efforts? I'm just curious where that's going. And does that give us then a lens into non-rail belt standardization of how could we get into IPP data or intertie data because of what we learned through the RRC IRP process?
This is Jeremy Casper. Short answer is yes. I think with the standardization that we're seeing being developed by the RRC, the data will improve and then help us present it in a more standardized fashion. Mm-hmm. With regards to the question about the rural utilities off of the rail belt, some sort of standardization, it's worth considering. Yes. Yep.
Okay. Then I'll follow up with that kind of in the same vein with the transmission organization effort and the tariffs. I assume that is creating a bunch of discussions about how do we harmonize transmission-related data so that we can measure it, analyze it, and then create rate plans out of that. Is that another lens into your intertie opportunity that can we look to that, or could we ask that process to be helping feed in some structure so that we have both within the rail belt, again, some standardization that would align with this gateway for data, but perhaps also a lens into how to look at other rural intertie so that we, again, are moving towards some common structures? Is that happening or could happen?
Jeremy Casper again. I think that's a discussion worth having. This group here, I don't think is probably the right group of experts, but you know, maybe convening the utilities as well as some of the other subject matter experts within ACIP, not these two, as well as other entities within the state, that would be a interesting discussion to have.
Mm-hmm. Great. Other questions? Yes, sir. Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Holland. I'd be interested to know if there is a way to add So part of the data set is a cost analysis from the consumer perspective, like megawatts generated and then amounts of that sold and the cost of that kilowatt hour. But it would be really interesting to note what the cost of the infrastructure was initially. And I don't know if that would be able to integrate into this data set, but it would help to say, you know, when you look at your pie chart or of all the different types of energy, here we built a dam and it cost $5 billion and it generated this much, and then it's selling for this much. It seems like there's a cost feature to build the infrastructure that's missing in there. Is that, do you think that's accessible data somewhere that you could add to this? It would be really useful, I think.
Dr. Hirschberg?
Through the chair, this is Diane Hirschberg. If it's a publicly financed project, that data is available. I think that is the question is who funded it. And I think you are asking a very interesting question. Even if it's not easily integrated in being able to pull it up by district, you know, with big projects, given the conversations we're having about nuclear, for example, there's the question both of what the cost is and who paid. So even, you know, if we could have case studies on the side about some of these energy infrastructure, I think that's a great student project. I mean, it'd be something we really could do. I appreciate this suggestion.
Yeah, thank you. And a follow-up, if I may. Yeah, I think that, you know, the way that we have energy rates structured are such that in a large amount of cases, the cost for the infrastructure is passed on to the consumer. And so some portion of that consumer data set that you already are collecting is an infrastructure fee. And so I think it would be, I don't know, it would really help me from like just a policy perspective to understand what is our cost to provide energy and infrastructure.
Right. Thank you. Representative and co-chair Mears.
Thank you, through the co-chair to Representative Ruffridge. That's a really interesting thought, because as we're looking at different energy sources, certainly some of them do have higher upfront capital investment costs. Like, you know, we talk about Bradley Lake all the time. Like, that initial investment was high. Well, hydro all over the place, right? That initial investment is high. A lot of those projects didn't happen without a government investment, but where we are now, we're much better off. And I think it's a similar conversation that's going to come up with nuclear, is that like the first projects that have got a lot of support from the federal government will be affordable and be able to be done. And at some point, you know, as we look to the future, you know, potentially as there's more projects done, then there's like a cost that might be more affordable. And then there's the middle pieces. So like knowing how we get to there from the investment that needs to be on some of the upfront things as policymakers for not just the policy part, but the money part of the policymaking is important. Because if we say this is just too expensive up front and we don't have a better concept of how we do along the line compared to something that's sort of like cheaper as we go along, but ultimately costs more. Yay, data. And thank you for doing that work.
Great. I wanted to touch on a couple of final things. I think one is PCE continues to be a huge challenge for us. And it's almost an untouchable challenge, because we really don't want to open the box because it's very valuable. But on the other hand, you know, from my perspective, it's trying to help offset a problem, but it is challenging because we really can't work much on the problem. And I'm wondering, and this is kind of a thought versus and a question, how could we be using this data to help us see more pathways towards reducing the need for PCE and perhaps accelerating REF work, rather than it always being an issue that we're defending? We can't talk about PCE because we don't want to open the door. But on the other hand, we're not strategically looking at that structure in order to say, how do we accelerate the path towards less reliance on even needing PCE, because it only benefits, and I don't mean to say only in a negative way, but it's not benefiting the businesses and local economies. It helps homeowners reduce the cost of living, but we've got a lot of other people that would benefit from it. And I'm wondering if you see a pathway where this data kind of overlapping with the ICER focus on public policy, overlapping with the ASAP focus on technology, could help us maybe speed up the process of addressing long-term energy costs in rural Alaska versus kind of protecting the systems that are at place. And we put a couple little crumbs into REF, far more less than what we could be doing or should be doing. Any thoughts on how you can help us?
This is Diane Hirschberg. I wrote down modeling because I do think this is something we don't have in as a tool, but it is something that, you know, ICER has obviously been working on building these modeling tools for the decisions you're making around fiscal options. And I do think for energy options, we actually should and could be looking at, and I don't quite know what the modeling would look like, but the nice thing is both ASAP and ICER have energy economists who already work together. And so coming together to build some modeling tools where you could look at what does it look like if you replace one set of subsidies with a different cost structure, or what does it look like when we invest here? And I mean, I think even this question about the cost of the infrastructure versus the cost of the energy produced, and that question about where do we pass on the cost to the consumer if the energy itself becomes inexpensive, but the upfront was so significant? So I think this actually is a really good conversation for us to bring back and make Steve Colt and Brett Watson figure out.
That would be helpful. You know, in a particular example, and I've talked a couple times with the folks from the Kotzebue Electric, is that the current structure we have right now really there's a disincentive for the utilities to do much with the projects, because if they have a very successful project, all it does is reduce the PCE, and they didn't really get any net positive place other than they, you know, reduce some costs, but the incentives are not well aligned. So what they've learned to do is to set up IPPs. Yes. And have a local entity create the IPP, essentially sell it for the cost that they would otherwise have paid. So we, in essence, protect the total cost because there's still the PCE. And now there's this new little, you know, source of money, which does allow the community to have benefited from the electrification project, but it's not getting to what we were really trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so we've got these kind of perverse solutions that are using the system to protect the system, but we need to get back to what are we really trying to do? We're trying to work on smart investments that lower the cost of rural energy. And I'm not sure it all comes together as well now. And I'm watching that issue, and I'm just wondering if you can help us with that.
And this is Diane Hirschberg. I think the other interesting piece, which Gwen and others have really been digging into in Iceland, is this use case for increasing demand in order to reduce the price. Yep. And so that also needs to come into that equation.
Thank you for that. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I just have kind of a random question, but I've heard about, say, anyone that has, I don't know, bulk fuel delivered by a barge. I'm just making up a scenario. But you have the largest fuel user in the area would be like the school, mm-hmm. right? And so the state is the one buying the fuel. And so they pretty much set the rate for the rate of what the fuel cost is going to be for the entire town. And so if we as a state are not being careful about making sure that we're getting the best price for fuel, we're actually just providing, almost bidding against ourselves in a lot of ways, making the fuel prices setting, because there's no economic, you know, it's just an economics by one contract. And I just was wondering if you had ever thought about that, looked at that at all. And if I just want to throw that out there. So, because I, it's just something I've heard brought up over time.
Through the co-chair, one example that we have looked at is actually the example of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative and their basically bulk purchasing power and some of their innovations in the supply route. And this is part of Dr. Holdman's PhD thesis. And yes, it's possible to basically minimize the cost for bulk fuel by being creative and strategic. Mm-hmm. That's a short answer.
Dr. Hirschberg?
Yes. So through the chair, this is Diane Hirschberg. I will say we have seen maybe the opposite that has not worked, which is in looking at school costs and geographic cost differentials. The last time we implemented the geographic cost differentials in the state was just before energy costs rose significantly. School districts did not have enough purchasing power to actually keep costs low, and most districts reported to us that any additional funding they got through a revamped geographic cost differential was eaten up by fuel. There's some interesting challenges, I think, with each district having its own. There isn't a statewide fuel purchasing for school districts. And so I think that means that those that are having to do the one time only at the price that it's at that time really doesn't lead to the kinds of efficiencies that maybe we would hope to see.
Right. Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess, we all like to have a free market, but when you get into, some of these areas are just, small and you have one supplier and so on. I mean, it's not even possible to have, anything that looks like, some kind of competition or something like that. So, I don't know what the economic solution to that is or, what we really should be doing, but I know it's an issue. So anyway.
Great. Thanks. Yes, Representative Edgman.
Well, as one rural resident here, I feel like I have to respond at PCE. PCE was never designed as a cost equalization for electricity service back in its early days in the early 80s. So it was never designed to lead to, although in years later with the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, I think, which was created in 2007, 2008, and a bunch of other initiatives, the search for more renewable energy efforts and what have you have been ongoing, unfortunately thwarted by the change in federal administrations where all the federal money that was coming in that made AEA a powerhouse now is to a lot of ways, it's either dissipated or it's being used up. Power cost equalization, of course, is funded by an endowment. $1 billion endowment that in large part came from surplus revenues and oil that also you could argue had subsidies in terms of tax credits and this, that, and the other throughout the state. Natural gas. We've got a gas pipeline in front of us that is, working off intellectual, the permitting, the right-of-ways and what have you. A lot of that was paid for by UGF dollars by the state. Well over $1 billion, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, all that stuff. So I'm not trying to get defensive, but I'm just trying to equalize a little bit the conversation. And in terms of schools, schools sometimes get energy on a prepaid basis. They get it lower than the so-called market rate might be in the community, whereas the retailer in the community charges more than what the school can get the volume at. I just had this conversation with one of my superintendents not too long ago. They allow their employees to a very limited extent to buy fuel based on the rate that the school got it, which is cheaper than they could get it if they went to the pump and so forth. So, I'll close by saying it's fascinating how highly subsidized so many things in Alaska really are. I could list you 10 items right now were subsidized one way or the other. And I agree with Co-Chair Holland's
you know, the direction of his thinking that we'd like to move off of those subsidies to the extent we can. And it all circles back to whether we get a gas line or not, because other than that, I don't know what the great equalizer is going to be in this state. And that's not even going to be an equalizer, because a lot of the natural gas isn't going to get out to the bush, right? Outside of the LASCO Affordability Fund, which is built into then Senate Bill 138, which creates 20% of the royalty from the gas line, which is going to be phase two, which is going to be many years down the road, is blah, 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 blah. So a fascinating conversation, but as a rural legislator, I feel like I had to weigh in on it.
Right. Thank you. Speaking of dollars and cents, how's this gateway funded in the next couple of years? And is it funded in the next couple of years to keep it going? It sounds like you've made a lot of progress with version 3.0, but requires time, energy, and money to do what you've done and to keep it moving.
This is Jeremy Casper. I can respond to the initial part. This was originally funded through a capital research project through the university, funded by the legislature in FY 2024, I believe. At the time, working with the governor's office, governor agreed to that first $1 million. And then the plan was in the following 2 years to fully fund that. That plan did not materialize. So we're still working on that FY 24 money.
This is Diane Hirschberg. We are down to less than 10% of that funding left, and we estimate we've got about 2 to 3 months. We're being very conservative, and we're trying to leverage other resources to support this work. But we are really nearly down to gas fumes.
So the obvious question is this in the FY 27 budget we're looking at right now?
Not as far as I'm aware.
Sure. Any other questions or any wrap-up from you? Thank you for all the work that you've done and what you've shown us about the progress that you've made. Any wrap-up you wanted to have?
Do you think you just mentioned we'll share this? This is Diane Hirschberg. Another fabulous collaboration between ASEP and ICER has been a nuclear energy university project, which, as we finish that up, also was able to support another iteration of a statewide survey on attitudes about different energy opportunities and resources, including nuclear, but also including the gas line. So this is for another longer conversation, but we do have the kind of rough data to share with you so that you can take a look. A presentation that was given during the had a recent one of the workshops leading up to the Alaska Sustainable Energy Conference, and a little summary of the data. And so we'll share that with you now, and we look forward to future conversations about this data.
Okay, very good. I look forward to that. And if we can get extra copies for Representative Costello and Representative Kopp, I'd like to make sure. And was there anything you wanted to discuss about that presentation, or are you just distributing it today?
We are just distributing it today.
Okay, thank you for that. Any final questions from any of us?
Right,
okay,
here.
Great. Okay, so thank you, Director Hirschberg, Casper, and Deputy Director Raymond. I appreciate the time that you've taken to come here and share what you're working on. I hope we can follow up on that. I know I've got a couple follow-ups from you on the PFD energy spending and the IPP data in terms of other examples that might help guide us in our thinking in this area on here. So that's going to conclude our business for today. On Tuesday, we'll hear a presentation from Chugach Electric Association on their new initiatives to pursue small hydroelectric projects in South Central Alaska. We'll also hear an introduction to House Bill 328 from Representative Kopp. So seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 2:34 p.m. Thank you very much.